The Earth? Oh, the Earth will be gone in just a few seconds.
Hello there. Welcome to another Word Monkeys podcast. Thanks so much for downloading. I hope you like it. If you love space and aliens and fun stuff, then I think you'll like this one because my Word Monkeys guest today is author, poet and space nut Dom Conlon. If you follow Dom on social media, you'll know how much he loves space. He loves it so much he writes poems about it, for goodness sake. For the last 2 years, I've been writing a book that is coming out on the 28th of June, 2018, a book called Aliens Invaded My Talent Show. A book which features, as you might guess, aliens in it. So my question to you before we get into chatting to Dom is, do you think aliens exist? Because I'm going to level with you. I think they do. I have no idea what they look like, whether they breathe through their eyeballs or eat raw sardines and custard or have a penchant for wearing corduroy. But I do think that they're out there. And the reason that I think they're out there is because I think it's mathematically probable. Insofar as the universe is big. Right, I know that's probably not come as a massive shock to you, but it is big. Recently, the space probe Voyager left the solar system. Voyager was launched about 40 years ago, and Voyager is traveling at a speed of about 40,000 miles an hour, and it is traveling away from the Earth. And it has taken 40 years traveling at that speed to leave our solar system. So it just shows you how massive our solar system is, right? Because that is, it's traveling very fast and it's taking a long time to leave it. Now, our solar system is obviously tiny compared to our galaxy. Our sun, for example, is apparently one of 200 billion suns in our galaxy. And then there are 100 billion other galaxies in the bit of the universe that we can see in the observable universe. So the maths say, and I've crunched these numbers, right, for you. I've done it for you. The maths say that even if only 1% of suns in the universe have planets orbiting them, and just 1% of those planets are like Earth, then there are still 2 trillion trillion places where life might exist. And that is a lot of places. It's just that they're very, very far away. And so even if aliens have mastered light speed travel, then again, the probability is that we won't ever get to see them. Now, my whole life I've been watching TV shows and movies and reading comics and books about aliens. And so I have amassed some favourites over the years, some of whom have actively influenced the aliens in my story. And I wanted to have a chat with Dom because I knew that he also has loved science fiction stories since he was a kid, so that we could just chat about space and science fiction and sort of like to have a little wandered through a list of our favourite aliens. So one day, about a month ago, I dialed that space bad boy up.
One of the things that got me into making more of a go of writing, I mean, I've always been a writer because I've been a copywriter for video games for 20 years, but one of the things that made me want to write books was space. Was sitting in a planetarium in Liverpool one evening and just listening to this amazing guy spin stories of the stars and the planets and the scale of the universe above my head, and it was incredible. And then I went away and started literally from that moment on, and on the train on the way home, writing poetry about space, because I'd Oliver at the time, and he was about 5 years old. And I wanted to get these incredible concepts and this sense of scale across. And I found poetry was a kind of good way to do that. But since then, I mean, I'm writing another one at the moment about the moon, and I'm inspired by the moon. But a lot of it, I want to also include, you know, chapters on prose, just being enthusiastic about, you know, how incredible it was that we went there, you know, within, you know, 10 years as John F. Kennedy put the challenge out to NASA. So, yeah, it inspires me. It's incredible.
Yeah, I'm sort of putting together at the moment, as we speak, a sort of show that you can take around schools and festivals and stuff for my book about aliens. And one of the things that really inspired me was seeing the photograph that the Voyager spacecraft took. I think as it was passing Neptune, it sort of turned around and looked backwards at the Earth and took a photo. And the photograph, essentially, it looks like the Earth looks like a sort of star from it's a distance of about 3 billion miles, I think. So it's quite a long way.
That Carl Sagan.
That's it.
Pushed for that, didn't he? For it to turn around and there was real kind of resistance against that. They said, no, it's a waste of time. It's not science. Just do it. But Carl Sagan always had this kind of real vision of how science could inspire. And he knew, and you're right. I mean, that prompted his whole Pale Blue Dot speech, which it still sends shivers down you.
It's an incredible
piece of writing. It really is.
It is. Beautiful.
That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives.
I've nicked it for my book. There's a bit in there.
Good for you.
Where I hadn't listened to it for ages, but I did. It's not sort of a word for word, rip off, but it's the spirit of it. I think the idea that there are these two kids who are looking down on the Earth from space, and they suddenly realise that everybody they've ever known, everybody who's ever existed, is on that sort of this sort of, you know, blue and green marble that's down below. The thing that I've really liked, again, it's just sort of willful impertinence in me, is the idea that there's an alien with them. Who, as they are sort of like waxing lyrical about how beautiful the planet is and how, you know, fascinating and astounding it is that anyone who's ever breathed, all the kings, all the princes, all the foragers, all the butterflies, all the dinosaurs were on that planet. How wonderful that is, that there's an alien there going, no, it's not. It's rubbish. That your planet's disgusting. Eric gasped as he looked out and saw far below them the whole of the planet Earth. From high up in space, it seemed so small. Eric couldn't believe that down there were not only his mum and dad and grandma and grandpa and aunts and uncles and cousins, but all the other millions of mums and dads and grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles and cousins too. He didn't know how they all fitted in. He stared at the Earth, unable to look away. He thought about all the people who were living there now and everyone who had ever lived on that small ball of rock. All the kings and queens and teachers and farmers and prime ministers and presidents and hunters and gatherers and pharaohs and emperors and soldiers and cave dwellers and blue whales and butterflies and dinosaurs. "Look at that," said Vinny, as wisps of white cloud moved silently across vast oceans of blue. "It's so beautiful." And Eric had to agree that it was. "Silence!" screeched Edard Udard. "Your planet is hideous and revolting and not at all beautiful."
Do you know, I think that's really good, though, because you've got there, and this is what aliens are often used for, aren't they, in literature, to give us a different perspective on ourselves. And putting us into perspective against, you know, the infinity out there and the possibilities is a really worthwhile thing. And to say, well, And essentially, you're right, that's what Carl Sagan did. He said, we're all on this planet, so we've got to really look after it because it's the only one we've got. And you know, the distances in space are just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And yet, and so getting to the nearest star, I mean, it takes light, 4 years to get from the nearest star. That's at the speed of light through a vacuum. You know, what is that, 300,000 miles per second or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Crazy.
186,000 miles per second.
There you go. There so you go. It's just, it's an amazing kind of concept. So that's your alien is absolutely bob on about pointing these things out to us.
That's right. That,
yeah, you know, clean up the mess.
Yeah. The I know that's the other thing. I mean, that's what I was going to ask you is like when you're chatting to kids, how do you convey the scale of even our sort of like small local bit of space?
Yeah,
because you sort of think that, you know, the Milky Way is in the grand scheme of the universe is just a speck of dust, and yet it's 100,000 light years across. It would take light traveling at 186,000 miles per second 100,000 years to cross from one side of the galaxy to the other. Yeah. I mean, you think that's in terms of and also that sort of then you sort of think about the chances of us coming into contact with alien life forms, and you think it's actually whilst it's, you know, mathematically probable that there is some other life out there in the universe, the chance of us coming into contact with it are just shatteringly remote, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, they really are. I mean, I love big numbers. I love the when kids engage with them, and finding ways for them to engage with it is a wonderful. I mean, the fact that again, I've been researching this, but moon poems recently. The distance when we look up at the moon, we think, oh, it's quite close, but the distance between us and the moon is enough to fit all the planets in the solar system between us and the moon,
right?
Which is just staggering.
Yeah.
If the Earth was a basketball and the moon was a tennis ball, and you get people, how far apart do you? Here you are, Matt. How far apart do you think they would have to be to scale?
What if the Earth was a basketball and the moon is a tennis ball? I'd say I don't know, meter.
Nope.
How far?
More than that.
10 meters?
That's 7 meters.
7 meters. Yeah, that is a lot, isn't it?
But by the same scale, I think, and my numbers might be off here a little bit, but it almost doesn't matter because the sense of it is there. The sun, by the same scale, would be 2 miles away.
Right, yeah.
So
that's mad, so isn't it?
That is just crazy. Yeah. You know, it's just... So I love things like that. When I do space talks with kids, you talk about the size of our sun and how big it is, and that it can fit a million Earths in, or 100 across the diameter. And you say, but our sun isn't big. If our sun was a ping pong ball, there is a star called Betelgeuse, which would be by that scale would be the size of the London Eye.
Right.
And they love this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I've got a load of things like this where you just throw in kind of these comparisons of ordinary things that they've seen, and you go, you know, if that was that, then this would be this.
Yeah.
And it just helps them glimpse as much as any of us can glimpse these incredible kind of distances.
The one that I always love is that, you know, light takes 8 seconds, 8 minutes to get from the sun to us.
Yeah.
And so the sun we're seeing up in the sky is 8 minutes old. So technically the sun could explode and we wouldn't know.
And the other thing about that is that it does take 8 minutes. But for that photon of light to actually leave the center of the sun where it's made, where the fusion process creates it, it can take about between sort of 30 to 100,000 years.
No way.
Yeah, because it's so dense that it's got to shoulder its way out of that. So you get a lot of kids, and you get one in the middle, say, right, you're the photon of light. It's going to take you 100,000 years to leave this dense collection of other kids in order to make your 8.5 minute journey.
That's insane, just, isn't it?
It is. Oh, I love this kind of thing. A man has just walked past my window. I need to point this out. A man has just walked past my window looking like Fred Flintstone. a proper fur kind of tabard sort of thing that with the black belt and a weird kind of haircut. And Brilliant. He's not dressed as Fred Flintstone. This is just ordinary summer wear up there, Charlie.
Look, water is leaking from her eyes.
It's what they call tears. It's a sign of their weakness.
Right, we're about halfway through the podcast. Hope you're enjoying it. Just a little note on social media. If you want to follow either myself or Dom on Twitter, then we would welcome that and enjoy the possibility of conversations about aliens with you. So if you would like to follow Dom, he very simply is at Dom, that's D-O-M, underscore Conlon, C-O-N-L-O-N. So that's at Dom underscore Conlon. And my Twitter handle is at Matt Brown Author. Get on Twits, come and find us and start telling us about your favourite aliens. So do you think that science fiction sort of stoked this fascination with space when you were younger?
Oh, absolutely. I think it does. I mean, well, two things really. I mean, for me, being given a telescope by my dad one Christmas, and seeing the moon for the first time, I never get bored of seeing the moon.
Mm.
That really made me want to read more and learn more about space. But certainly reading books sort of in the library, local library, going through all those was really important. You know, things like H.G. Wells and John Wyndham.
When did you read those? Were you quite young when you read those?
Yeah, I was. I was probably about 12, 13. Mm. I read fantasy first, probably. But then I read, I think it was on holidays, I started picking up books in W.H. Smith's, by paying father now, hasten to say. E. Doc Smith, the Lensman series, and the family D'Alembert, and these kind of stories of adventure going across the stars, you know, jumping in a spaceship and then joining a space circus and things like that. They were just fantastic. They just transport you.
Yeah.
And then H.G. Wells was, I mean, he was so far ahead of his time.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. I reread that last year. War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I read it as a kid. I certainly was like hooked when I was about 8 or 9, when we first got a video machine. The War of the Worlds, the 1950s movie, was one of the first films that we got, and I would watch it over and over and over again. And it was what was fascinating to me, I think, is in my head, the book was set in the 1950s. Because I'd seen the film. Obviously, he wrote it in the 1890s. And the thing that I was struck by was, A, how modern the story is, how sort of like relevant it is, or it feels very relevant to like 2018. And how the only thing really that is different or is strange is the absence of any technology on Earth. You know, everyone has to get around on horse and buggies and stuff. There's no cars. There's no technology at all on Earth to speak of.
No, you're right. The writing itself is so pared back.
Yeah,
that it is almost modern.
I don't know if you've ever read any Alan Moore graphic novels.
Yes, yeah.
The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yes,
which is one of my favourites. And anyone who has only seen the film versions of Alan Moore graphic novels needs to sort of disabuse themselves of the idea that they're all terrible, because the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen is essentially just classics of Victorian literature sort of coming together to make an Avengers style, you know, task force. But the H.G. Wells features very heavily in that first those first comics, which I thought was brilliant. And again, I think is telling of how sort of creative those aliens and that situation is when H.G. Wells wrote it, that sort of almost 100 years later, Alan Moore created that series based around the alien invasion from Mars.
Do you know, I think that's really interesting, because I think, isn't that a good mark of literature where your ideas are still so relevant? And I suppose Shakespeare's another one that comes to mind when that you talk about this kind of thing, that people can go, do you know, this is still so relevant that we can use this as a to look at the way we live today or the way we're going or anything like that. And you're right, War of the Worlds is still, I mean, Spielberg did his film as well.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you could keep on remaking and it would still be important. You know, there is still a lot that it says that's relevant.
Yeah, I think so. And there's a great graphic novel that I've got called Scarlet Traces, which is set just after the aliens have died. And but it's like a sort of exploring the idea that there was all this alien technology left behind. What would humans do with it? And inevitably, humans go mad with power.
Yeah.
But again, I thought that was another really interesting little spin-off from it. And as well, I guess the way that the aliens die in that book is just, it feels very modern. You know, you're talking about germ warfare, effectively, aren't you? Something that is actually sort of tangibly sort of scientific.
And it's the big, well, it is, you're right. It's the big fear now when we explore space. I know after the Apollo 11 mission, the astronauts were put into quarantine for something like 2 weeks because we were frightened of moon germs. We didn't so much worry about what we took there, but we worried about what came back. But conversely now, when there's talk about missions to some of the Jovian moons, you remember when Cassini crashed on Saturn?
Yeah.
Well, they crashed it onto Saturn rather than one of the moons because for fear of contaminating one of the moons. And if we ever went to any of the Saturn moons or the Jupiter moons, the Jovian moons, there is that constant conversation about we've got to make sure that we don't accidentally destroy sort of a life that could be, you know, billions of years in the making, by infecting it.
That's incredible.
I was hard pressed to, when you asked me about this, to think about where I first met aliens in books. I think television and film probably did most of the work.
Yeah.
But then that prompted me to want to read about more science fiction.
No, absolutely. And also I can remember, again, when I was about 8 or 9, I guess, also the Eagle comic being relaunched.
Yes.
And so the Mekon coming into focus, which again, I suppose, is like a 1950s vision of a Martian in a classic little green man with an elongated bulbous head. But again, I remember that again is just, it's that sort of is just quite a profound marker in certainly in my life, that idea of certainly of aliens being hostile and aliens being little green men.
I mean, that was born out of the paranoia, wasn't it, of the Cold War, and the kind of whole idea of the Russians and the Soviets, rather, and, you know, are they going to take over our way of life? And as often, you know, the fear of the foreigner is a massive kind of trope in science fiction and how we deal with it. And I think that's always still a sign of the times. It's probably used more cynically now than it was at the time, in a way. But going further back, the sort of number one alien who we probably don't think of as an alien was Superman in the comics.
That's very true, yeah.
A beacon of light because he was our alien. You know, he was friendly and he stood out for truth and justice and the American way. So, but he was an alien.
And the other alien story that I remember seeing was, it's called Village of the Damned, the film, but it's The Midwich Cuckoos is the book
Midwich
that
it's
Cuckoos,
based
on. The children in that, I thought they did a really splendid job as well. I think the book is amazing, but I think they did a really good job in the film of conveying the oddness of children being aliens that are powerful and capricious.
Yeah, they did. And I look at my son and sometimes think, yes, you are an alien. You just, I don't understand you at all.
Yeah. One of the other that you, there's on the list of other things that you mentioned was Perigee and Me. Or Perigee and Me.
Ross Montgomery, yeah.
That is something that it's completely passed me by, but look, from looking at it, as I...
You must read it, Matt, seriously.
Oh, I really want to.
And do you know, I said this to Ross, that when you get to a certain point in the book, he lulls you rather cleverly and meanly into thinking that this is a certain type of book. And I was almost thinking, oh, I'm not sure where this is going at all, because have I not seen this book before? And then he does something which is just extraordinary and devastating. Brave, really, really brave writing.
Don't tell me.
I'm not going to. And I said this to him. I said, that was an incredible decision to do that. And he said, yeah, he said, that kind of gets mixed reactions, whether I should have or shouldn't have done it. And I'm just glad he did. I mean, you must read it. It's a wonderful book.
I will. I shall go to my local bookshop and buy it immediately.
Good.
But it's about, I'm looking here at the synopsis, and it says there's a girl, Caitlin, discovers a shrimp-like alien on the shores of her island home, and she takes responsibility for teaching it about the world.
Yeah.
But mostly this just involves stopping little Perigee from eating everything.
Yeah. that doesn't even begin to cover kind of the book. Because in some ways you could say, well, that just sounds like E.T. But we need to have another conversation after you've read it.
We do. Okay, that sounds good. Now you've mentioned E.T. That was one alien that was not on the list of aliens that we were pinging about between each other.
No.
But again, that was something that I remember having quite a big impact on me when I saw it in the cinema. It must be one of the first films I think I saw in the cinema.
Right.
And of course, I would have been, I don't know when it came out, 82, is it 83, something like that? I'd have been about in sort of 9 or 10 when I saw it and loved it as a story of an alien creature, you know, sort of lost and on the planet and needing to get back home. But now when I see it, it just, it's even more powerful now when I see it, because I understand that actually it's not a story about an alien at all. It's about a boy coping with the divorce of his parents.
Yeah, yeah. And when you learn more about Spielberg's life at the time as well,
yeah,
and his own divorce that he was going through,
yeah,
it really is. It's quite a dark story. Once you learn a bit more about it as well, it's brilliant.
It is, isn't it? And at the time, at that age, that was when my parents divorced, and so I must have. Sort of, it must have been weird, sort of my dad taking me to see that in a funny way, or maybe he was oblivious to its to its subtext, but now it just breaks my heart in a whole new way.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. And one of the other things that I loved about E.T., because I remember all the rumours that were going around school at the time, was that Steven Spielberg actually knew, he'd been let in on this big secret from the government, that there were aliens and that we'd already seen them and made contact. And Spielberg was hired to help prepare the way and to soften us up for the ultimate reveal when we go, oh, yes, well, we've seen the film now.
Amazing.
This is extraordinary. So my conspiracy brain was, oh, this is wonderful.
That's incredible.
Yeah, I just added something else to it, that we were just being prepared for the normality of alien life.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, listen, Dom, are there any other aliens you'd just like to give a little shout out to?
I'm going to mention Phoenix because it's a book my son's just read, Vajak Paul by SF and Saeed, and I'm now he's got that because it takes him a while to read new books. He sort of likes to go over his old ones before he'll brave anything new.
Yeah,
especially a new genre. And he loved Vajak Paul. He was absolutely over the moon with it. So I said, right, because he's not a big science fiction fan, my son, at all. And so I said, right, you've got to read Phoenix. And the aliens in Phoenix are wonderful.
They're good, aren't they?
Yeah. And again, you know, like many good kind of stories, teaching us what it is to be human.
Yes. Good science fiction, good alien stories have that at their heart, don't they? They sort of are able to hold a mirror up to ourselves so that we can see what arseholes we are.
absolutely, and I'm looking forward to reading yours.
Brilliant. I can't wait for you to read it.
I really am genuinely because when you first held up the cover and I saw the title, I thought this is just perfect, this is a great way in, and it'll be your usual mix of absurdity and profundity, and I'm genuinely looking forward to it. I really am.
And there we have it. My thanks to Dom for spending the time to just shoot the breeze about aliens. He is a lovely bloke, and I could happily spend hours chatting to Dom about all manner of things. So, if you would like to listen to any other Word Monkeys, then there's now a huge back catalogue. I think this might be episode 40. So there are 39 other amazing episodes for you to choose from. All you have to do is go to Stitcher.com or Acast.com or find me on iTunes or Podomatic.com. Any of those places where you can download podcasts, you'll be able to find the Word Monkeys. So check them out and spread the word so that other people can hear them as well. Anyway, there'll be another Word Monkeys along very, very soon. So, you know, don't go resting on those laurels of yours. Until we meet again, have a great day/week/month/year. Goodbye.